Hello, and does it hurt to be dead? Welcome to Best of the Rest, the show where we take a second look at movies that were poorly received upon release and challenge ourselves to only talk about the things we like and what the movie does well. It's Pepsi Month, and this week we are talking the 1999 film Stir of Echoes. My name is Chris Logan, and I am joined, as always, by my open-minded co-host, Andrew Williams. You ready for this one, Andrew?
Who you been talking to? Open-minded? What? No. Anyway, yes, I'm very excited about this.
as am I. Andrew, yeah, open-minded. Do you... if you can try to give me a yes or no here. Andrew, do you believe in ghosts?
The ultimate knowledge is in knowing that you know nothing.
I knew as soon as I thought to ask you that question, I would get an answer that did not satisfy me. But do you have strong opinions?
The answer is I don't know. Okay. Because at the end of the day, I have not seen anything. I think I've told you this story before. I don't remember, but I have not personally experienced anything that I would consider to lead me to believe the supernatural is a thing. I want to caveat this with, this is not me saying that it is not, does not exist. I am saying that I have not personally experienced it. Now, what I will say is that there are people who say they have experienced it. And I am not the kind of person who's going to stand up and be like, well, clearly that didn't happen. Because I don't see the value in that. There's a story I heard Grady Hendrix tell one time. He used to work at a paranormal psychology center that fielded calls about people, about the supernatural, or whatever paranormal thing they had. And this woman called one night, and she was, and before that, the rules they were kind of given was like, don't validate, but don't invalidate. Tell them that there's never been a proven story of ghosts hurting anyone, and tell them that they're not crazy. Basically, you're not crazy, no one's going to hurt you, but don't invalidate it, but don't validate it either. Basically, get all the information, tell them they're safe, tell them they're sane. And one call, he kind of had to break one of those rules because there was a woman who called in and she was hysterical. She had just had a child and she kept seeing her dead mother next to the crib. And she was very, very upset about this. Very, very uneasy. It happened.
Can I interrupt
times.
1 second, Andrew? One,
sure.
It's 1 second. Real quick, I personally am not really a ghost person, but these stories like this always get under my skin, and you just casually mentioning she saw her dead mother next to the crib, I got chills on my body. Like, this isn't even, you're not even going into detail. It's just that idea, like, sends shivers down my spine. It's crazy.
It's very, it's, and when he told this story, I felt the same way. Like, I don't even have a child myself, and I was still like, huh, like, that would just be so unnerving. That's why she was so kind of hysterical. And so she's kind of like really asking for help. Like, he's trying to get all the details, but like, she's very much like, so he's giving her like the spiel and she's not really having it. She's kind of like, she's like, I understand everything you're telling me, but I need to know what to do. And he finally is just kind of like, she kind of goes on. And he kind of finally is like, he just finally in a moment goes, have you talked to her? And she was like, well, no. And he's like, try that. And that was, you know, that was validating the experience, and he really wasn't supposed to have done that. But, you know, he gathered all the information, filed it away. They got off the phone. A couple weeks later, she calls back, which was very rare in this job he talked about. It was very rare for people to call back. You know, he had people call about, you know, Hillary Clinton was spying on them through X, Y, and Z. Like, it was a lot of stuff like that sometimes, like, very clearly. Stuff like that, I would like to say I know isn't true, but I guess I don't know that either. But
sure.
But this woman actually called back and basically said, hey, I really want to thank you for what you said, because the next time it happened, she kind of sat and just started talking to her mom that was standing there. And the mom never spoke back. She never said anything. But at the end of the conversation, she's like, I felt a really big sense of closure that she'd never gotten while her mom was alive. And since that moment, she's not come back. And the way he kind of put it is, you could say that that was any number of things, but why would you want to take that away from someone? Like, if that experience was able to do that for someone, why would you want to be the guy that says no? And that was a very illuminating story to hear for me, because I'd never really thought about it that way. Because, you know, it's not hurting anybody to think that, hey, the spirit of my mom showed up briefly and we were able to kind of have a moment together that we didn't get before she passed. And that's, you know, it's, why would you want to be the guy that says it didn't actually happen if it was so meaningful to someone else? And like I said, unresolved grief, you could number any number of things for why it was happening or what it was. But at the end of the day, why would you want to be that person?
The answer is
I don't.
I do believe, I do believe you have told me the story off mic, but, and I think a line you used or that, you know, he had said there was something along the lines of there's a fine line between ghost and dreams. Is that correct? Is that from the
something same? Like that? Yeah.
Yeah. Which really stuck with me. And it's definitely something I've reflected on, like, since we've talked about that. And yeah, like if that person experienced that, then it's real. They have that experience. Like, you can't, mm-hmm. It's a thing. It's an experience. What is real if not someone's experience? And that's really right, all like, you need to know about it. And is it a memory? Is it grief? Is it ghost? One, why does it matter? And two, what's the difference? Really? Yeah, I mean,
that's, I think, like, a thing he kind of mentioned too that I thought was really interesting is, like, you know, you're walking down the street and you think you see someone, but turns out it's someone that's been dead for years, and you look again and they're gone. It was a memory? Was it a ghost? What was it? It's the same. It exists in that same space of, like, in that moment they were there and then they were gone again. And what do you, yeah, like, you know, maybe the idea isn't so much are ghosts real as much as what exactly is a ghost. And there's a large conversation to have there that doesn't require you to invalidate the experiences of others, especially those that have gotten closure from it. And we need to stop talking about this because I'm getting a little verklempt and yeah, I don't want to be sad anymore.
I like... To tie it into this movie we're talking about here today, Stir of Echoes, I like exploring the idea of ghosts where the ghosts aren't the boogeyman or the bad guy or the killer or what have you. Like, this is a psychological thriller. It's you could call it a horror movie, horror thriller, but it's not about a killer ghost. Like, the ghosts aren't the bad guy or the evil. And yeah. I like that approach. Not that you can't be a good movie going the other way, but it can be a very broad topic to explore. And I think this movie does a great job of it. I mean, real quick, I'll say it up top. I really enjoyed watching this movie. I've got a lot of positives to say. I'm so excited. We are diving into it today to conclude our Pepsi month. All month long, we've been talking about movies that one way or another got overshadowed by a similar premised film that came out in close proximity. In the case of Stir of Echoes, well, this came out in 1999, and it is about, in part, a young boy who has the ability to see and talk to ghosts. Just like that other movie that came out in 1999 called The Sixth Sense, that was the biggest movie that decade, that year. I mean, it was a phenomenon, right? So it's just swallowing this movie up, even though it released first. Like many of our movies we talked about this month, that ultimately doesn't matter. And its legacy just kind of gets washed away amidst the greater sort of cultural impact of the Coca-Cola movie. Is that fair?
Which is a bummer.
That's what we're looking at this month. And by and large, in the movies we've examined, like I'm so glad we're taking this deep dive on them because they can now occupy their own space in my brain separate from the more popular movie in most cases. Like, you know, we started off with Deep Impact, which I think was a great way to start off because I really enjoyed it. I've been thinking about the movie a lot since we watched it. And up and down this month, I mean, these movies, we talked about this a little bit before we record. It's like, yeah, I get the comparisons, but ultimately they really did their own thing with this film. I mean, they really went in a different direction. That's been true over and over again all month long, but here we are, Stir of Echoes. Andrew, what's your history with this movie? Did you see it in theaters? Have you seen it before this week preparing for this podcast?
I don't think I saw it in theaters. This would have been 99. I would have been 12. I don't quite think my parents were taking me to see shirtless Kevin Bacon in digging around backyards and basements when I was 12. Yeah, this wasn't the kind of thing I went to watch. And I have seen it. Like, I remember seeing it on, like, TV. I remember seeing clips of it. Like, there's specific scenes that I very much remember in my brain. And I know I'd watched it before, but I've not watched it in its, like, entirety in a really long time. And so I was actually really excited to go back and check this one out.
Yeah, I saw it, I think, exactly one time. I rented it probably on VHS not long after it came out. And I remember liking it, but I think I said this last week when we were talking about what we're covering this week. Just like Toby in our Discord, I remembered Kevin Bacon digs a lot and something about fingernails. And that was it. Those were the things that stuck with me. I really didn't remember much. As I watched it, a few other things clicked into place. But wholesale, like, tons of scenes were, like, completely, like, didn't feel familiar, but I know I watched it. And I'm glad I revisited it because I really enjoyed it. I also remember distinctly, I don't think I own this movie on DVD, but this is probably the first DVD I can remember that had, like, special packaging. It had a clear slip cover that goes over. Like, the DVD cover is, like, Kevin Bacon's face, and the slip cover was clear except for this black, like, goo that drips down it, so it just made the cover look real dingy, but you could slide it off. And it wasn't like a, you know, collector's edition DVD. That was just, as far as I remember, it's like the standard DVD, and that's like one of the first times I remember DVD packaging doing that. And that's pretty much been the legacy of this movie for me. A really cool DVD, and I remembered something about fingernails. But yeah, we went back. I really liked it. I'm excited to talk about it. Let's set the stage a little bit here, Andrew. This movie is released September 10th of 1999. It's made on a budget of $12 million. Pretty small budget. At the box office, however, it only makes $23 million. We're looking at maybe breaking even. Critically, it's pretty well received. It holds a 68% critic score. On Rotten Tomatoes, audience is pretty similar. Most critics, even at the time, are acknowledging that it kind of just gets lost in the shuffle. I mean, after all, Andrew, it comes out in 1999. Pretty good year for film, as I have stated quite emphatically. In,
don't know that it's the best year.
Recent. I put it as number one, but that is debatable.
What year did I say again?
Oh, you don't remember what year you think is the greatest year of all time for film? You don't remember, Andrew?
No, I was just trying to beat you. It was 1957, which was the year he was writing this book that this movie is based off of. So again, 1957 in spades.
The year he was writing it. That's very, a bit of a Johan level stretch to tie it together, Andrew, but I'll allow it.
Oh, it is. I'm still going to make it.
Also released in 99, just amongst many other things, but these are the ones that, like, the Wikipedia blurb shouts out as a reason this movie maybe was overlooked. Was, of course, The Sixth Sense, like we talked about, The Blair Witch Project, and The Mummy. So, plenty of
the
other...
The Mummy
supernatural
seems
like, I mean, there. It's technically a dead person coming back to haunt people, but it was a huge movie.
It was. I don't think anybody saw The Mummy trailer, though, and thought... I don't think anybody saw Stir of Echoes trailer and went, too bad I already saw The Mummy.
Fair enough. Andrew, as you just mentioned, this is based on a book. The book is called A Stir of Echoes, written by Richard Matheson. And that did come out in 1958, which is pretty cool.
A long ago.
I know the movie makes changes. I don't know the specifics because I kind of want to read this book. So I didn't want to, like, dig too deep into what all they changed. Obviously, they updated. I mean, the movie takes place in modern times. But something about the idea of someone writing a horror book in 1958, obviously I know what happened. I mean, that's been around forever, but I don't know. It's a thing where we judge the past unfairly and we think that they didn't have our sense of humor or our interest. And I know it's unfair, but still, the idea of someone writing something like this in 1958, you know, this is before Psycho comes out. Andrew, Psycho invented horror. How could someone possibly write a story like this before then? But they did. And I definitely want to check it out.
Richard Matheson, I feel like I've talked about him before on the show. I think I mentioned we do I Am Legend here? No.
We have oddly talked about it a few times.
We have. I feel like there's been a reason I've talked about Richard Matheson before on this show, and I can't remember what it is. But no. Real Steel, no. Yeah, did you know that he wrote the story that the Hugh Jackman robot boxing movie was based off of?
No, but that also seems like, wouldn't that come out? When did the book come out?
The book would have been put out in 1956. The story, it was a short
That's
story.
So weird. That's because it feels like a modern idea. So, yeah.
Weird. But Richard Matheson was like, he was just fantastic. He wrote so many. He wrote like 16 episodes of The Twilight Zone, including many, many that you are familiar with, including Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. He wrote Little Girl Lost. He wrote Death Ship. And he actually wrote all of the monologues that Rod Serling read during the episodes as well, which was not always the case. He also wrote Star Trek episodes. He wrote Steel, actually, which was also an episode of The Twilight Zone. So actually, believe it or not, there's an episode of The Twilight Zone about robot boxing. In 1963. He also wrote a bunch of Edgar Allan Poe adaptations for Roger Corman. He's got, you know, short stories. He's got novels. He's got things like I Am Legend, which was turned into The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price, then Omega Man with Charlton Heston, and then obviously I Am Legend with Will Smith. He turned The Shrinking Man, which was made as The Incredible Shrinking Man. Stuff for the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. He's had another kind of classic haunted house book called Hell House that's seen by like almost anybody that writes haunted house books will tell you that Hell House is like one of the kind of monoliths of the genre. He's kind of one of those semi unspoken heroes of like science fiction horror, yeah, because you don't really hear his name a lot. You don't hear it as much as you hear it, like, say, you know, like Stephen King is obviously like the big horror name that everybody knows. But when you start looking at classic horror and classic fiction and classic kind of sci-fi, you don't always hear his name, and you should, because he's really, really good. Like, you know, you hear about Ray Bradbury a lot. You hear about Harlan Ellison too, but Richard Matheson is a monolith. He's fantastic. He has written so many things, a lot of stuff you may not even realize he wrote that you've seen, like the Something on the Wing of the Plane episode of The Twilight Zone. That's Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. And like, almost everybody knows that reference, or at least knows that it's a reference to The Twilight Zone, and that's him. So, I mean, what greater legacy can you ask for to allow people to make fun of the way William Shatner acts? So,
I literally, as you were saying it, I was thinking of Jim Carrey, Ace Ventura 2, I think it is, when he looks out the window and goes, "There's something on the wing. Some thing." Which, of course, as a kid watching it, I'm like, John Lithgow sounds nothing like that. Why is he making such an exaggerated impression of this well-known story we've all seen?
That's one of my favorite gags on Third Rock from the Sun ever, is when William Shatner shows up as their boss getting off a plane, and he's like, "And I looked out the window, and there was something on the wing of the plane." And John Lithgow goes, "The same thing happened to me." And I was like, this is a joke that I love so much and will never tire of.
This movie is written and directed by David Koepp, alum of the show. We've talked about him a number of times, even if he wasn't directly involved with the movie we're talking about. Because, well, let me just do a quick sample of things that he has written or co-written. Death Becomes Her, Jurassic Park, Mission Impossible, Spider-Man, Panic Room. This dude's credits are insane. He also occasionally, as is the case here, directs the film as well, such as he did with Secret Window, such as he did with, that was a weird thing I just said, just like he did with Secret Window, Premium Rush, and this one here, Stir of Echoes. And what I love about those three And I'm curious if this is part of his decision-making when he decides he wants to direct the movie itself, is those three movies are all so low stakes, and there's such an isolated, contained story, small cast, and I love them for it. They feel so refreshing for that reason. I mean, that's true of this movie, Stir of Echoes, we're talking about Premium Rush. We've brought this up a lot on this podcast before. Usually we're talking about the greatest actor of all time, Michael Shannon, but that is such a cool little, I guess, action movie, but the action is like Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, riding his bike through the city, being chased down by Michael Shannon, who's a corrupt cop. And it's, like I said, it's all like small stakes, someone saving the world or even like saving other people's lives. They're just kind of like, it's just happening to them and or them and their family. In all these cases, you know, Secret Window is Johnny Depp alone in the cabin, and then John Turturro shows up. This movie here, we'll talk about the cast in a second. There's maybe like five people we need to talk about to really cover all the main cast. It's so small, but in a way that I really like.
I agree, actually, and I feel like as a director especially, that makes a lot of sense, because you can have something, you have a lot more control, and you don't have to worry about, you know, kind of intense, big budget. I mean, like, you kind of left out even here, like, two of the movies that he's written recently, he wrote the last two Indiana Jones movies, or co-wrote them, which are huge spectacle movies that are massive, and obviously, we've talked about him specifically before, because he wrote The Shadow, and also wrote The Mummy, or co-wrote The Mummy, right. The Tom Cruise Mummy. So, I mean, we've talked about him directly there, and we've probably had these exact same conversations that we're having now. But because there's no way to check. There's no way to go back and see.
No way to know.
We talked about this before. But yeah, like, I feel like especially, like, if I were, like, starting to move into directing, which he did direct a couple of things before this, but one was a short film, and then the other was a movie called Trigger Effect, which I admittedly haven't seen. But then you see that pattern of, like, Stir of Echoes into Secret Window, and even stuff like Ghost Town, which was a weird one with Ricky Gervais. Like, it's another one where it's kind of just like a guy living his life. Like, it's not like a big spectacle. It's not an Indiana Jones. It's not something like that. So I think
Mission Impossible or Spider-Man or Jurassic Park. I mean, like, when he's writing, you know, when other people are directing, it seems to, you know, he can write the big epics, but like, he doesn't.
He wants somebody else to make that.
Sure, yeah. Not that it's always his call to make, but I just, right, it can't be a coincidence that it's the smaller, more intimate stories that he steps into the directing chair.
Yeah, he did do another one with Kevin Bacon after this a couple years ago called You Should Have Left. The reception is not quite as glowing. It is, in fact, quite mixed, but I think...
I want to check it out, though.
Psychological horror film written and directed by David Koepp starring Kevin Bacon is something that I'm gonna watch. So let's hurry this up.
Let's hurry it up. Let's move along. Let's jump into this film, talk about everything we like, all the positives about Stir of Echoes. Andrew, you ready to do this?
Yes.
After being hypnotized by his sister-in-law, Tom Witzke begins sensing a strange presence in his home. After seeing the ghostly figure of a young girl, he becomes obsessed with communicating with her, but struggles to consistently make contact. Tom and his wife Maggie soon find that their young son also has an ability to communicate with the deceased. After receiving the message to dig, Tom finally begins to find the answers he's after when he uncovers a dead body in his basement wall. I mean, hopefully you've all seen this movie already. If you haven't, go watch it. I'm kind of spoiling stuff already in this synopsis. There's more to it, but as we were just talking about before the jump there, Andrew, I like how small this scope is, how simple this story is, but not in a way that feels like it's boring or lacking. And man, visually, this movie just does, he makes so many cool choices that I'm really excited to dig into here.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, sorry, we forgot to add in a spoiler warning there at the beginning, but maybe sure, you can add one in post. But yeah, it's kind of hard to talk about this movie without just full on explaining the plot. So But yeah, it's an interesting one for sure, and I'm excited to talk about it. But that scope, like you said, despite the kind of otherworldly nature of it, the scope is surprisingly, I don't know if small is the right word, very focused, like very, yeah, very, very narrowed in on what it's doing and what it's dealing with. And I will tell you this, after watching this movie, I really wanted to take a shower. I was like, it was just so, he's so dirty by the end of this movie. I was like, just hose me off, please.
Before we talk about all the scenes, before we talk about dirty shirtless Kevin Bacon, we have to talk about the cast, as we always do. I'm going to start with the high point, best casting, best performance in the film. Because every episode, we recognize one person who goes so far above and beyond the call of duty that they actually elevate the quality of the entire film with their performance. And we recognize that person by giving them the Mark Strong Award. So, Andrew, kick us off. Who's getting your Mark Strong Award for Stir of Echoes?
It's got to go to the man himself for me. It's big old Kevin Bacon. The bacon. Man himself.
Bringing the home bake. The bacon.
He's bake. What are you going to do? But by the nature of the story being told here, he is given the most focus. Even his ghost speaking child doesn't really get as much focus as he does, because he really is meant to be the major vehicle for this movie.
Sure.
And he does a good job. I mean, he's kind of presented as this kind of, I don't know, like, not necessarily the most dialed in of partners to his wife and child at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Kind of the implication is that he's drinking a lot, that he works a lot, which, as you work as a phone line man, is a great combination, let me tell you. But, you know, you're not given a lot of insight that he's necessarily the best dude. Likes his music, all that, and then has this, obviously, this awakening, and then he has to like start shifting as a character. And I think every single piece of it, he's up to the challenge. He's got no issue rolling with where the character needs to go next. Obviously, the dude is relatively jacked, so when he has to dig up his backyard, he looks good while doing it. If not, very dirty. But just he's even got like this. But at the same time, despite him being Kevin Bacon, like, I believe that he's these things. Like, he's not like when they try to make Tom Cruise seem like a normal guy, and you don't really buy it because you're like, Tom Cruise isn't a normal guy.
I'm so glad you bring this up, Andrew, because that is exactly what I was thinking watching the early scenes of this movie. Like, they go to like a house party, and on some level, he's Kevin Bacon. He's a beautiful man. Yeah. He's a movie star. Yeah. We know his face. So whenever he's, trying to be blue collar, like, some of it, he has a natural stardom, but he really blends into that world. It is very believable, much more so than, the Tom Cruise example you were just saying there. It probably helps that he has this. I mean, he always talks like he just rolled out of bed. He's always got like that vocal fry thing going on, like the frazzled voice that he's very good at. But yeah, he is very believable. I, also getting my Mark Strong Award, by the way, just throw that out okay. there. I agreeing with you 100%. He does get the most to do. But on top of, like, that's not the only reason he's getting this. He is giving a hell of a performance. He, you can tell, put a lot into this. And
oh yeah,
this is a story about a man that becomes obsessed, and he, when he gets like that tunnel vision and he's like driven to do this thing and find these answers, you believe it. I mean, he looks like he hasn't slept in 2 days. He looks like a soul's been sapped out of his body. He looks like a living zombie. Like, he is in it 100%. And man, I love Kevin Bacon. He is genuinely one of my favorite actors. Probably the reason I saw this movie at all back in the day is because it was a Kevin Bacon movie and I wanted to check it out. Interesting career, because he's kind of like, we'll compare him. Let's see. We talk about like Michael Keaton, greatest actor of all time, right? He kind of has like this, he rises in the 80s and really becomes a movie star. He's got Batman and then kind of like wanes throughout the 90s. So that the early 2000s. He's really taken on crap roles and making movies that no one sees, and then shoots back and has this renaissance that we're loving. We've seen similar things with, Brendan Fraser and Josh Hartnett. We see these people rocket to movie stardom, dip down, and come back. Kevin Bacon is like He's kind of like that. He had his heyday, first really big, like, movie stardom, like, in the 80s and early 90s. But he hasn't really, like, dipped and come back. It's like he'll have, like, one movie pop off, three movies you never heard of, two movies pop off. It's just up and down. He's just over. He's never,
yeah.
We never had that Kevin Bacon renaissance. But, like, you can cherry pick throughout his career some real high points in either good performance or critical darling or movie star type performances. But I get the impression that he chooses roles based primarily on his creative feelings about it versus financial. This is a $12 million movie. He makes tons of independent stuff, but he's not afraid to jump into a Hollywood movie. I like it. I like the choices that he makes. But dare I say, we are due for a true Kevin Bacon renaissance. Let's get this guy some awards, give him his flowers while we can, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, and he's got like some interesting, like Animal House is probably the first movie he did. And he's like a minor character there. But like, I remember watching that for the first time. And let me tell you, you want movies that have aged flawlessly?
Oh, I bet.
You watch Animal House. That movie, nothing problematic about that movie.
Do a double feature with Revenge of the Nerds, Andrew, and you will have just two perfect
movies, you know, that no have complaints. Stood the test of time. Folks, I am very much joking. Please do not take me seriously on any of those statements. Animal House, and then obviously Friday the 13th, the original. Like, obviously, another big kind of monumental thing for him.
Maybe
obviously,
the best kill in that movie. He gets an arrow through the neck. It's pretty gnarly.
It's pretty gnarly. A little movie called Footloose came out in 84.
One of my favorite movies of the 80s, full stop. I don't know if I've said on this podcast before, but one of my favorite 80s movies.
It's absolutely wonderful. Obviously, he was in a big John Hughes movie called She's Having a Baby, which was the one where John Hughes kind of broke the mold and suddenly his movies weren't guaranteed successes anymore. But has a very notable cameo in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles racing against Steve Martin for a cab that he wins. And I think the joke or the gag is that he's supposed to be playing the character in the movie that comes out the next year, She's Having a Baby. But I don't know. That's a weird one. But and then obviously throughout the years, we've got stuff like, yeah, Tremors, like another big movie that I love, that
like on
a B horror movie. Like
on paper, it's Jaws on land, but in execution, it is a perfect, flawless movie. It is a perfect movie. It is so good.
It's fantastic. And the whole cast there too is just great too. I know that's who's the other guy in that movie, the other main guy, Fred Ward.
Yeah.
And then Michael Gross, Reba McEntire is in Tremors.
Yeah.
Like, it's a strange movie. Like, it really is wild. But and then you've got stuff like JFK and A Few Good Men. Like, I'm just running through his whole career at this point. But like, and these are all like, these are not the only movies he's doing. Like, he has got like
Apollo 13,
other things he's doing. Apollo 13, which is just a few years after, like JFK is 91. A Few Good Men is 92. Apollo 13 is 95. And like,
good,
there's
run.
Stuff all mixed in there. That's a pretty great run. He does a couple of voice things in there. And then obviously we got Stir of Echoes in 99. He did that Invisible Man movie in 2000, Hollow Man. I remember seeing that one a lot. That was another formative movie as a Ute. But and he was in Mystic River, which maybe I'm not the biggest fan of, but got a lot of accolades and a lot of awards when it came out. So just like you said, he's kind of never really gone anywhere. And then even dipped into the superheroes genre with X-Men First Class there. And I will say this, Kevin Bacon as Sebastian Shaw, that's great casting.
Really good. Alum of the show, R.A.P.D., we got to talk about him there.
Yes, we did.
Another comic book
and
film.
And so, did dip back into the slasher genre a little bit with They/Them, which I won't say anything else about, because it's probably a candidate for the future. Otherwise...
I was excited to check that. I haven't watched it, but
it could have been more.
Okay.
How I'll put it.
All right.
And then still out there, he will apparently be playing the captain in Beverly Hills Cop 4, which, you
okay.
know, we're all looking sure. forward to. But also, it looks like he plays like a sleazy PI in Maxine, the kind of third installment of Ty West's X trilogy. That started with X and then flashed back to the prequel Pearl. And now we're kind of getting the final installment, Maxine, which is about the survivor of X kind of in the 80s, the heyday of the 80s with the backdrop of the, what is that serial killer's name? The Night Stalker. I thought Night Stalker was Kojak, but that's also correct. But But Kevin Bacon like shows up in the trailer and he's playing like the sleazy, gross looking PI. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm going to enjoy every scene where he devours the scenery from everybody else around him before they could even get to it. So anyway, Kevin Bacon rules. So,
yeah,
nothing else to say there.
That's the main point we're making here. We probably spent more time talking about his other movies than his performance here, but he's great in this movie. We'll talk about him more as we go through the scenes, but let's take a look at the rest of this cast here. We have Catherine Ayerby as Maggie, his wife. I've been referring to him as husband and wife. I think they're married.
Yeah. They're all Witzkies.
Okay. Oh, right, right. Look at the last name. Good detective work, Andrew. She's doing a good job. As Kevin Bacon gets more tormented and obsessed, I like that there's not really a scene where she's like, I'm leaving you and I'm taking our son. It's like she's worried about him and she is really getting, not treated very well and ignored. But it's all from a place of like, I need to find a way to help him. It definitely strains their already tenuous relationship, but it doesn't go the easy route you could go with this character. It takes a more nuanced approach as far as how the wife would approach this and try to find her place in it and help him and do what she can. And I like that. I think she plays it all very well, both the love and care and concern, as well as the fear with the, you know, potentially losing her husband to this crazy obsession. And she even becomes like an audience surrogate for a while as she kind of researches and learns a little bit about what's happening to him. Again, as she tries to understand what exactly is going on with her husband.
Yeah, it's like you said, Kevin Bacon is being slowly kind of driven to the point of madness almost, and she's kind of trying to help him keep it together. And she does a good job with that. I mean, it's mostly just kind of along for the ride. Obviously, she doesn't really believe what's going on at first. And then she kind of does figure out what's going on, but then there's still this kind of, you know, he's not being open about what's happening. So she, you know, I can't help you if you won't talk to me. And it's a good performance. It's got to play against a lot of really weird stuff going on. And I think she is up to that task.
Rounding out the family, we have Zachary David Cope as Jake, their young boy that can see and talk to the dead. Of course, the plot point that gets all the comparisons with The Sixth Sense. He is very young here, under 10 years old, I would guess, and does a good job. You know, thumbs up for me on the child actor scale. They all get thumbs up, fair warning. But interestingly, I want to champion this kid because he seems to have gotten out of the industry. I mean, literally his IMDb is just this movie. There's an uncredited role in The Wedding Singer, apparently, but those are the only two things I can find on him that he did. And like I said, I think he does a good job. But hopefully he's out there living a normal, healthy life, and more power to him.
He was one of Adam Sandler's sister's kids. That's who he was in Wedding Singer, the sister that he lives with, or the ones that he babysits for. The ones that are like, are you going insane? Like, or are you having a nervous breakdown? They're the ones that keep asking inappropriate questions. He's one of them. A much smaller part, but, and his hair's way different. Very different. It's like a blonde, almost pompadour in Wedding Singer, and it's just normal here. But, but yeah, it's interesting, the way he has to play his character. And I think he does a great job, like you said, especially as the movie goes on. Because like when it starts off, you can see that it's kind of a novelty for him talking to this person. And it's fun. It's kind of just, oh, hey, this is my almost imaginary friend. Like, you know, a Shining or whatever have you. But as the movie goes on and the spirit, whatever, starts getting more and more kind of desperate slash almost unhinged, he starts getting more and more kind of afraid and concerned. And, you know, that line he says of like, I'm afraid of the feathers, or he says, watch out for the feathers. Then when you find out what that means, I was like, oh man, that's like, that was almost a bad one. But yeah, he does a great job.
Ileana Douglas plays Lisa. This is Maggie's sister, the one that hypnotizes Tom and sets all these events into motion.
Not cool.
Ileana Douglas, very distinct, interesting looking person. Fantastic actor. I know her face so well. And Andrew, I don't know why. I mean, she's done a million things. She's been in stuff you've seen. But, like, I couldn't find that one role that I was like, oh, yeah, I saw that movie a ton or that TV show a ton, and that's why I know her. But, like, I know this woman's face very well, as is probably all of you if you Google it, if you don't recognize the name. But it's probably just because she's just done a million things over the decades. But fantastic actor, I think very well cast here. You know, she's the sister that's into the more...
A little out there.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the appropriate words for it. Yeah, not...
Spiritual.
Spiritual, thank you. Thank you. I'm trying not to say hippie and quirky, because that's not quite it, but...
Yeah, not it.
Into those things. I like it. Very well cast. I mean, she's very believable. I like whenever he comes over desperate for help for her to fix whatever she did, and she's like, I'm high, but I'll try. It was very funny.
Yeah, she does a great job. Like I said, this I know she was in a couple episodes of the Drew Carey Show back in the day, but I'm like, there's no way that can be it, right? There's like, there's no way that's the reason her like face is in my brain.
You have the same feeling though, right? Like you see her, you're like, oh yeah, I've seen her. Yeah, like, yeah.
And maybe it's this. Maybe she. I just saw her in Stir of Echoes, and I've just been like, that face, I'm never going to forget it. That's not meant bad, people. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying she just has a very distinct look. But I know she was in Ghost World. Like, so there's stuff she's in that I know I've seen, but I'm like, I can't. Like, I didn't. None of it is like a I saw that all the time as a kid kind of thing. But anyway, she's got an interesting role here. Like, it's like she did this by accident. Like, she wasn't trying to make him have these abilities. She was very much like, I just want you to be more open-minded. And by asking him to be more open-minded, or by putting the suggestion to be more open-minded, she inadvertently makes him able to hear, you know, or communicate with spirits or whatever.
It's kind of like a genie situation where, like, you know, the genie misinterprets what you're saying. She's like, yeah, I said to be open-minded, but, like, I physically opened your mind to receive, you know, all messages.
Yeah, it's a monkey's paw. Like, I want you to be more open-minded. The monkey paw curls. Great, now you talk to dead people. How more open-minded can you get?
She was in 6 Feet Under? I watched a couple seasons of that. Maybe that's it. I don't
know. I like how she's in Quiz Show as Woman at Book Party.
Yeah.
Like, I know I've seen Quiz Show, but, like, I don't know if I remember.
It's probably not the thing you know her from.
Yeah. It's not Cape Fear, and it ain't Goodfellas. And it's not Last Temptation of Christ, where she plays crowd member. So I really don't know. Maybe it's The New Guy.
I don't know. We'll never know, Andrew.
We'll never know. There's no way to find out.
That really covers our main cast here, though. There's other parts we'll talk about, especially to go through scenes. I mean, I've got to shout out Kevin Dunn as Frank McCarthy.
Yeah, we gotta talk about Kevin Dunn. We can't.
We just talked about him in Small Soldiers, how he is that guy you know, even if you don't know what you know him from. And here he is popping up twice in the same month. Again, playing a dad. That's what he is apparently very good at. Great performance. And there's like three shades to it. There's like, he's an everyday normal neighbor, and then he is like a haunted man when we first see him in a vision, and then see him after he loses his son. And then there's a bit of a menace to him in some of his final scenes, and he plays them all believably and very well. Like I said, we talked about it earlier this month. He's just a great actor. You've seen him in a million things. It continues to be the case here.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a fan. He's a character actor. He does his job, and he's doing that exact job here. But like I said, you get a little bit more range out of him here than you normally do. Normally, when he's in something, it's kind of very, I don't want to say one note like it's a bad thing, but he's being asked to do a very, like in Transformers, he's playing Sam's dad. So the whole time he's basically playing like the dad that's like, I can't believe what's happening. Like, that's literally what he spends the whole movie doing. It's just kind of seeming incredulous about what's going on around him. And here, like you said, and his son doesn't die. His son's in the hospital. They're not sure if he's going to make it, but you know,
thank you.
He's still living with he's still living with the fact that like his son did that. And it's right. like, oh geez. And also he knows why his son, he already knows why his son did that. So he's also compounded in that way as well. So like I said, I actually really liked getting to see, that's why I was like, there's no way we're passing up Kevin Dunn, because like the range he actually gets to show here, I think is actually like where I was like, oh, this dude's actor with like capital A, like he's got the, he's got the chops.
The scene where his son kills himself when no one's home, him and his
son
wife
shoots
show
himself
up
when no one's home.
I'm sorry, I keep saying that. Shoots himself when no one's home. They show
I
up.
I hate that
as...
you're having to make me make this distinction. It's still awful. He's just not dead.
You're right. They show up as he's being loaded into the ambulance, and he is frantic and screaming, and he literally screams, "Is he alive?" And his performance on that like broke my heart. Like what an awful thing to have to play. Like
just what an awful thing to ever have to think. Like you have to like ever have that thought. Like I couldn't imagine that. It's terrible. And he sells it. Like, and then again, as the movie wraps up towards its conclusion, you see like you understand that there's so much more layers packed into all of these things. Like obviously, we're not I don't know if we're talking about the big third act twist, but you know, you realize there's a lot more going on here than you realize, and it makes the performance all the more interesting as far as I'm concerned.
Let's work our way up to that. I mean, we covered the cast we need to talk about. We can talk about more as we go through scenes, but I'm just excited to talk about this movie. I want to jump into it, Andrew. So let's do exactly that, starting with the best scene of the film, or at least our personal favorite. So, Andrew, in your opinion, when is this movie firing in all cylinders? What's your favorite scene in Stir of Echoes?
This is a tough one because I actually like quite a few scenes in this movie. And I like, there's a lot of really creative sequences here. But I think the one I kind of like the most is the initial hypnotizing scene.
I agree.
Just because
I agree.
That's putting you in his point of view of like what he's seeing during all of this versus kind of the much more, I guess, common of like the exterior of like, so like you're seeing him and like, she's like, you're in a movie theater and you're the only one there. Everybody else like showing you the screen with the letters out of focus and like bringing it into focus.
And like, as she adds details, you see it visually change. Like everything is black. And then like a wave goes across the screen and all the seats and the walls turn black as she describes it. Yeah. You're the only one there. Everyone disappears in the movie theater. It adjusts the visuals as he falls deeper and as she gives her instruction. Such a cool visual, so cool and creative.
And that, yeah, it was, it, and Kep talked a little bit about how they shot that scene. I mean, the little blurb on Wikipedia here says they shot it, and they painted basically everything. They actually painted everything black so that it had the appearance of everything being black except the screen, which was kept white. And it adds this whole different layer to it because you're not just seeing like the movie screen with all black around it. You're actually in an all black movie theater with the white screen, and it adds to that perception just a little bit and keeps you in it a little bit more. That theater is apparently in Joliet, Illinois. I will have to see if I can track it down, but you know, cause that, you know, that's what I should do with my time. But but this whole sequence was, it works. It's unnerving in a way of just like how it creeps in. And then the way it kind of snaps back to reality once he starts getting the visions of Samantha and what's happened and the fingernails and once that all hits back and he snaps back into it, I was like, I almost snap out of it too at the same time. Like when he like violently comes back to it, I had the moment of like, oh, you're all right. There's no reported instances of a ghost hurting anyone. My experiences are valid and they're not invalid. It was very well done, extremely well done. And that's, you know, you talk about Kep doing smaller focused things. This is probably one of the more auspicious scenes in the movie, and he crushes it.
There's a lot of visual flares throughout, but this is definitely the biggest example of it. And they go back to the theater later in the movie. It's also very cool. But for that reason, my favorite thing about this movie, I think the story is super solid, very smart. Unfolds in a satisfying way. Great actors. But it's the visual flares that elevate this movie for me and make it something special. And film is a visual medium. This is so cool. This is the kind of stuff you should be doing. you could effectively tell the story with her hypnotizing him. And in the movie, we're like looking out of his eyes and his eyes close and it goes black. You could do that and then jump to him waking up. And they're all like, dude, you've been out for 10 minutes. So I put the clothespin through your safety pin through your hand. You could do that without ever physically seeing what he saw, but this is so much more interesting, so much more immersive. Yeah. And again, it's a movie. It's a visual storytelling. Give me the visuals. A lot of examples of it. We'll talk about the other ones as we go through those scenes, but this one was just the coolest. So for that reason, I wanted to highlight it as my favorite, and I'm glad you're agreeing, Andrew.
Yeah, this is just, this is where it really, I was just like, this is different. This is not what you've seen. This is not The Sixth Sense. This is not Blair Witch. This is different. And just putting you inside the hypnosis versus the outside, which is, like I said, what you tend to see, that just makes it all the difference. And, I do want to point out Richard Matheson actually was alive when this movie came out, and he actually got sent the script to this, and he liked it. So apparently it cool. got the Richard Matheson seal of approval. But this movie is I want to talk about some more stuff. Can I talk about some more stuff now?
No, we're done, Andrew. About the credits. Right.
Okay.
And...
yeah, we're done. Thanks, folks.
Yeah, continue, Andrew. Please keep praising.
All right, I
got to
go.
Movie.
The Tooth. The Tooth is next. Oh, my God. Because this was done practically. And, like, it's one shot.
I saw that.
It's,
that's cool.
It's nuts. That's crazy. So, like, it's... so, you know, the sequences... He's got definite sequences now where it's like, you are freaking out, man. And, like, one of the ones, he goes to the bathroom and he, like, looks in his mouth. He's got blood coming out. Looks at one of his teeth and it's loose. And he literally, like, pulls it out. And I was...
my note there says, why do they always pull it out? Anytime you see a character in a movie feel a wiggling tooth, you know they're going to pull it out in a gruesome way. They always do that. Why? But this looks gnarly.
May I ask, Chris, is there a non-gruesome way to pull out a tooth?
I don't know. Whenever you
the
lose
act itself
teeth,
is
like as a
gruesome.
Kid, you know, they just pop out. It's not that bad. But, like, whenever... I don't know, like it's rotting. Like,
allow
this.
Me just... to rip this bone out of my jaw, please.
And like they pull it slowly, and there's always like stringy stuff still attached to it. Ugh, it's nasty.
Yeah. No. Anyway, they put like a cap over his tooth. They put like a little veneer on there, and they added all the sounds and everything. But like, he literally pulled it out, and then he like had a real tooth that he dropped into the sink at that point. And then like while they were down on the sink, somebody came over and cleaned up his face. And then he like looks up, and it's clear. And I'm just like, man, that's... they don't do them like that no more. I mean, no. They probably do. Somebody does. But just what it's a really cool touch. It makes it feel that much more authentic. But man, it is so unsettling.
What I love about it's an unsettling scene early in this movie. And you could chalk it up to being like a lot of ghost stories do. Like, oh, creepy stuff happens. It's a haunted house. And it doesn't really mean anything beyond that, which is fine, I guess, but this is so much more satisfying because there's a narrative reason behind it. The whole movie is about him being compelled to find this girl's body because she is presumed missing. Her family doesn't even know she's dead. It's getting closure for the deceased. Very similar theme to like what The Sixth Sense ends up doing. And one of the ways that he finds her is learning what happened to her. One of the things that happened to her was getting a tooth knocked out during an assault. So, like, that same tooth coming out of him is them, like, connecting and him feeding on the energy of that house. Like, it makes sense narratively beyond just being a creepy scene, which is very satisfying stuff. I mean, this movie ties up every single little bow by the end of it, not in like a ham-fisted way, but very satisfying way for sure.
It sets up the pins and it knocks them down.
Yep.
My understanding is that's just how storytelling is supposed to work.
That's good storytelling. David Kep, he knows what he's doing, turns out.
I always love, like, it's that, I've joked about this to you, let's start that over again. I've joked about this to you before, but just that idea that, you know, you hear a lot now that like media literacy is like at its lowest because it feels like people just aren't aware of the things they're watching, or they're literally like noticing basic narrative devices and treat. Yeah. They're like, did you guys see this Easter egg? And what the, like, an example would be like, did you notice the Easter egg of early on in Stir of Echoes, Kevin Bacon has a hallucination of pulling one of his teeth out, and then we find out later the murdered girl had a tooth pulled out? Like,
right.
That's literally a video someone would make right now, and it would be like, yes, that's called foreshadowing, and it's gonna come back later. It's literally been a narrative device since fiction has existed. Hell, it exists in history. Like, there's foreshadowing in history. Things happen in history that are like, wow, you got to wonder if that's going to come back and pay off later. And then, wow, it does. I have a lot of thoughts about that. Anyway, moving on.
I agree. This movie has a very tall aspect ratio. It fills up the entire 16:9 ratio of most of our TVs, which is nice and surprising. Usually in like more narrative-driven stuff like this, small stake stuff, you get the more letterbox. I don't know the aspects off the top of my head, but you know what I'm talking about, where you still have black bars top and bottom on a 16:9 television. And because like talking heads are framed a lot better, so that's what's used more often. And usually the tall aspect ratio is like action movies, and you know, we're trying to fill the whole screen. So it's interesting that on this small scale movie, they use the tall visual. But I think in some way, it's a little unsettling because it's not normally how you'd shoot this kind of story. And then whenever we do have some creepy visuals on screen, it's so much more in your face. Like something that I love, this crazy thing happens whenever they need a babysitter. And the girl that shows up, we learn more about who she is later. When he opens the door, the frame just turns like a harsh red. Like this red filter, and you hear like a slight buzzing. And then Kevin Bacon kind of reacts, like he blinks his eyes. So clearly he felt or saw what we saw. Again, film's a visual medium. Give me that weird red filter. It's such a strange, because there's no like music in the score that with like a sharp note or anything. The screen just turned red and you're like, what the hell just happened? And that's probably what our character is thinking. Like, why did my vision just go red when I saw this girl? I love that. It's those little flares and those touches that are just masterfully done here. And tie it back into that tall aspect ratio. I think stuff like that is more impactful because of the bigger screen.
I agree. No notes.
All right. Can I keep talking about this movie, Andrew? Can I say more stuff?
No, it's time to wrap this up. Play the wrap it up music here now. Anyway, I love the, first off, the red light effect, I think is very, very cool. The way that whole sequence is handled from like the first moment it happens. And like every time he sees a red light, whether it's like a car or like a stoplight or anything, like it's the same effect. And it's basically like warning him. Like it's actually like, it's Samantha basically telling him like, hey, something's about to go wrong.
Yeah.
It's interesting to kind of see that change, because that's a specific change in Samantha's behavior. Samantha being the missing at this point girl, going from this point here where she's like, hey, something bad is about to happen, to like later where she's almost being malicious and like causing almost bad things to happen because Kevin Bacon's not doing what she needs to do. Or what she's asking him to do. And, but that whole way that sequence is handled, like just getting into his brain, like, and like, I'm not going to lie, like the flashing red lights with that, like that would drive me crazy. Like that would literally make me not want to do anything. And so the way that all builds together, again, just talking about how it all flows as a film, but just it's meant to be an unsettling visual, and it is perfect. It is effective. 10 out of 10.
Maybe it's just been a while since I've watched a thriller like this, but everything was so effective to me. Early on, there's a scene where, you know, weird stuff starting to happen to him after he's hypnotized. He walks downstairs because he can't sleep. He sits on the couch, and like as his body crosses the frame, a young girl is revealed to be sitting on the couch next to him, staring at him. And I had like it was effective. Like the hair stood up on the back of my neck. And again, it doesn't I mean, it kind of plays like a jump scare, but like he jumps up and she's still there. She tries talking to him, but it's like, it sounds like she's like underwater. Like it's all like muffled. You can't make out the words. And then she's gone. And it's nothing groundbreaking. Like, you know, a girl shows up, a dead person shows up in a ghost movie, but it's just handled so well. There's anytime she shows up, she also moves in a very strange way. Like it's a different, it's like she's in, they must have shot her in like a different frames per second and then sped it up because she moves almost like she's in a silent film. But everyone else around
her is moving. Almost stop motion. Yeah. Like,
yeah. Everyone else moves in like a normal way. And again, it's one of those things where like, is it just there because it's trying to scare us and be creepy? Yeah, probably. But our main character is probably scared and feels unnerved by this. So whether or not he's physically seeing her move in that way, it's just conveying this strange feeling to us. Like, this thing shouldn't be here right now. It's different. And film is a visual medium. That's the kind of stuff you should be doing. And David Koepp is so good at it. I love it. Anytime she shows up and he gets to do those little creepy touches, so well done.
Yeah, it again, it adds to the entire experience of it. It adds to the tense kind of feel of the movie, the overall tone. And it's just, again, it's those visual flares, like we talked about, that just really drive it home.
All right, let's start ramping up to our big conclusion to this movie here. We've talked about Kevin Bacon. He digs a lot. He gets all sweaty because he gets hypnotized again. He wants his sister-in-law to undo what she did. She's like, all right, let's go back. You're in a theater. You're by yourself. And we see those visuals again, but Samantha, the girl, is in the theater. And he's like, there's someone here. She's like, no, you're by yourself. And he can't get her out of there. Another word is revealed to him, but this time it's dig. So now he is just digging up his entire backyard. Again, just a man obsessed, right? It just literally just doesn't even acknowledge his wife talking to him or walking by. And he's digging these holes. He's shirtless. He's all sweaty. It's somehow the most iconic part of this movie, I think. It seems to be what everybody remembers. And we get a great laugh here, funny enough, because he's like, he's got a water hose. Like, he digs a big hole. He sprays it with water. He starts digging again. But his wife comes out and she sees the backyard. And she goes, why are you doing this? He just says, water softens up the dirt. And he keeps digging as if she was asking, why are you spraying it with a water hose and not, why have
why
you dug
you
up our
up
entire,
entire backyard?
Backyard? it's very good. And I even love this. He eventually escalates to like using a jackhammer in the basement to break up the concrete. And like you have these shots of all the neighbors like looking and hearing, you know, these crazy noises coming from this house. And then literally the guy across the street looks up and he's like, it's a rented house. very good. But Andrew, as he digs, of course, he eventually does find something in the walls of this basement. It's a dead girl. It's Samantha. He touches the corpse and he finally gets the whole vision of what happened to her. While this house is being renovated, the young son, the teenage son of the house's owner and his friend, which is another neighbor's kid, are in the house by themselves. They've been drinking. They ask Samantha to come in from off the street and they make advances on her, take advantage of her. When she refuses, they get violent. She starts screaming. They cover her face to shut her up and end up killing her. And that's how we know, you know, obviously she was killed and the body got covered up. That's all we know at this point. And I guess we'll just go all the way with it. What we do find out is that, you know, he feels like the right thing to do is to tell the boy's parents, hey, I'm going to call the cops, but like, you deserve to hear it from me. And they already know about it. We learn very quickly that the parents helped cover this up. The girl was already dead. What were we going to do? There's no bringing her back. Why ruin our son's lives? It's horrible, but it's, I don't know. What does a parent do for their kid? Like, it's just a tragic situation every way you look at it. It ends up the two different dads have different approaches here. One of them shows up and straight up wants to kill Kevin Bacon to keep this thing buried. He's saved by Kevin Dunn, the other dad, who says this has to end here. Like, we can't keep trying to bury this.
Okay. Yeah, it's actually a really interesting sequence of events there that I really do like, because you're led to believe that Kevin Dunn pulls out a gun and Kevin Bacon, another line that I just in the moment I thought was kind of ridiculous, is he pulls out the gun and he looks at him, he's like, who are you planning to use that on? Because your brain is kind of assuming he's going to kill Kevin Bacon, but then you are led to believe that no, Kevin Dunn is actually probably going to kill himself. And then you're led to believe that he does that. Like, there's a gunshot after Kevin Bacon leaves the basement. And then that's when it's Connor O'Farrell as Harry Damon and Steve Rifkin as Kurt Damon, those Kurt being the son and Harry being his father, that come over at that point. And they, you know what's happening at that point. They know what's going on. And they basically start roughhousing with Tom. Maggie gets back and gets caught in the middle of this, and it goes back and forth. And right as it actually looks like Harry's about to get the upper hand, Kevin Dunn, Frank, reappears and shoots them. And like he says, it ends here. He's like, at this point, we're actually murdering people. He's like, we're no longer covering something up that's already happened. Now we're perpetuating the cycle of violence. We are now just going to murder people to keep the secret. And he's like, that's too far. And then he says, he sits down on the porch and says the line, I swear to God, he says four times in this episode, this is a decent neighborhood. Well, it was. Well, it was.
They were going to kill you and Maggie. What I love about this finale is everything was set up in such an organic way. Like, we know, we find out that Kevin Bacon is renting a house from his neighbor that was recently renovated. And their sons are friends. We learn all these things in a way that doesn't feel like they're trying to set up the finale of this movie. It just feels like world building. It just feels like this block is full of parents that are close to each other. We know that their sons have a bright future. They have a scholarship because they're good football players. Like, we learn all these things in a way that just feels like, yeah, we're just learning about this world. But the way it all comes into play in the finale of this movie is, I mean, that's, like we've said, that's what makes satisfying storytelling. It's just the payoffs are so good. Everything gets wrapped up. You know, Maggie and his son are away because someone in the family had passed away, so that's someone else's house. Jake, the son, doesn't want to come back to the house. He's scared to come home because of the feathers. You mentioned that line earlier. Well, in this battle where they're trying to kill Tom, a gun goes off. It goes through the floor, it goes through their son's bedroom, through his pillow, where he would have been laying down, and feathers from the pillow are floating down the room. Like, every little thing gets paid off. It's so good. I loved this movie.
It all works. It all fits together, and it's just, it's so well done. The visions he has, like I said, we mentioned the tooth one, but then even the earlier one where, like, Kevin Dunn's in the house and, you know, like he says they're going to kill both you and Maggie. Like, you know, in that moment, it doesn't even make sense in the immediate aftermath, because when he wakes up, he does, the second half of that vision is true, but then that part isn't. And you're kind of like, okay, well, what does that mean? And then it comes back around. They're at that point, Harry, I think the guy said his name was, Harry is like, I'll kill anybody I need to keep the secret. Like, I'll kill you guys, put you in the wall myself. I do want to shout out Jennifer Morrison, who plays Samantha Kozak. She is our kind of, she is the murdered girl / semi-vengeful spirit that is speaking and communicating to Tom and Jake throughout this film. And I believe Liza Wheel plays Debbie Kozak, her sister, who is the babysitter who tries to run off with Jake early in the film. Jennifer does a pretty good job. She plays that role where she, you know, the minute she goes into that house, you know what's going to happen. And it just makes me feel so gross. Like, you know what's going to happen. And it's just, it's so unsettling. And, like, obviously, you know, this girl just, you know, she didn't ask, you know, nobody asked for this. And then just you watch it happening and it's so uncomfortable. And then as she's, like you said, the way they choose to play her as like the spirit, it's so effective. It's so visually interesting. And she does a great job with all of it. So shout out there.
And I love in the background of all this, you mentioned like at the beginning of this movie, Kevin Bacon's character, he's not the best guy, probably not the best husband. Seems to be an all right dad, but at the very beginning of this movie, we find out that Maggie's pregnant. They're going to have another kid. And literally his reaction, I mean, he's just staring there dumbfounded whenever he finds out. And Maggie's sister says, well, say something. And he says, bummer. And it's like, man, that is the worst. It's so shitty. And I mean, like, you don't really like his character at the beginning of this movie. He does shortly after. He's like, no, it's great. It's great. I'm stressed. I'm working a lot. And we, you know, get into the, they seem to be okay enough, but they definitely have their issues. At the end of this movie, you see a U-Haul van, which I'm like, good. Yes. Move. Get the hell out of there. And there's this sweet moment where like Maggie and Tom just pass by each other and they touch hands. And they linger for just a little bit on their hands touching, and then they come, and it's just this little, again, visual, because movies are a visual medium, just showing that they have bonded and become closer through this experience. And that's the kind of stuff that, like, you don't have to weave into a movie like this, but it makes it so much better when you do, just so much deeper, so much more relevant. And then I really like, you know, as they're, we talk a lot about how contained this movie is. While they're driving out of this neighborhood, their son's in the backseat. He's looking out the window. As they pass these houses, he hears countless voices in every house. A stir of echoes, if you will. He's hearing from so many ghosts and dead people reaching out for help. And it's... And then, like, it reaches and covers up his ears because it's overwhelming. And then that's when we cut to black. And it's just like, I mean, it's kind of a hopeful ending until that little tag. It doesn't feel like they're setting up any kind of sequel. It doesn't feel egregious. It's just like, this is a blessing and a curse. It's definitely a curse for a young child to have this ability when they clearly don't understand what's going on. I mean, it is... almost, it's just an ominous way to end this movie, but I like that note that it ends on.
Well, because the notion is that, you know, your brain is kind of like, oh, we've solved the problem, therefore the issue is over.
Yeah.
But, you know, and for Kevin Bacon, maybe the issue is over until it isn't. And so we're seeing, though, that, like, because with Kevin Bacon, he had to have this ability, like, awoken in him. It was not something he just had. Now, his son just has it, which means that no matter where he goes, this is probably going to happen. Now, the son actually does appear in the direct-to-sci-fi original television movie Stir of Echoes, The Homecoming, starring Rob Lowe.
Character of the son, not the
character
actor.
Of the son. Okay, the actor is not. So the character of Jake Witzke is in that movie, and he is kind of treated as like the guy who knows how this works. So, obviously though, I like the more ominous ending that just, you know, for Kevin Bacon and, his wife, for Tom and Maggie, this is a moment that brought you closer together. But for Jake, the problem might just be beginning for him. So,
you know, we talked about the obvious Sixth Sense comparison, but also there's a strong, similarity to The Shining going on here, right? With a young boy with this ability, down to the young boy and the mom meet an older black man that also has the ability and recognizes that ability in the son. There's, if you've never looked at the magical black man trope, it's a thing, and it's not the best thing that movies have done, but It's literally to the point where, like, that could have been, like, an homage to The Sixth Sense. I mean, it probably isn't, but, like, the fact that they did that casting for that guy, and he literally said, you know, in The Shining, he says, you know, I've always called it The Shining, and here he says, oh, your son has the eyes, I think is how he says it. Which is just another little way of saying the exact same thing from The Shining. But that was, I don't know, I guess I can throw a little, you know, hashtag PP and all. I don't know if it's necessary to meet this man. And then, like, there's like a support group of people that have this ability and they struggle to deal with it. And it, I don't know, it's not bad. But maybe that's the weakest part of the movie for me is kind of...
Ultimately, I guess the problem for me is that that sequence ultimately really doesn't lead to anything. Because right, the implication yeah. seems to be that she's going to use this to sort of understand what's happening. And like the piece of information she gets of like, ask what it wants. Kevin Bacon gets through other means.
Right.
That he doesn't use that. That information is not used by Kevin Bacon or Jake to accomplish anything. It's meant seemingly more for her to understand what's happening, but then, and I don't know, like Kevin Bacon's also not communicating to her what's going on, and that might be part of the obsession, that might be part of that, but it is the one piece that like kind of doesn't lead to anything. It's kind of a dead end. You could cut that entirely, and the movie doesn't really change. Yeah, that's that. Like, I don't think it holds it back, and I don't think it's like ruining the movie or anything, but it is definitely a little weird.
Hashtag positivity podcast here. Tracking that man down late at night in a shady part of the city is the reason she has a knife in her purse, which comes into play in the finale of this movie.
That is so true.
There is a little.
I don't appreciate the Chicago stereotypes, David Kep.
Yeah, knives. That's what Chicago is known for, right? All those knives you guys have up there?
Terrible.
Yeah.
We all have guns here. We imported them all from Indiana. We know what we're doing. I guess to be fair, everybody else has a gun. Like Kevin Dunn has a gun. The other dad has a gun. Everybody else has them.
Yeah, I mean, I said already, I really like this movie a lot. It's just a cool, tight little thriller. It's so good. If you haven't seen it, well, we've ruined it all for you, but you'll still enjoy the experience. Go check it out. Go watch it. Go watch it again if you haven't watched. If you're like me and like you're like, oh, yeah, I remember something about a fingernail and dirt. Go back and watch. It is so well done. I mean, everything David Kep, I've seen three of his movies, I think, that he's written and directed. I've got to go check out the other Kevin Bacon movie you were talking. You Should Have Left, that we said the title was.
Yeah, I almost said it was, I Think You Should Leave, but that's the Tim Robinson,
the Netflix show. Comedy very show different. Also
it's very,
also good,
very, very different. I do like that show, immensely, but now I got to double check what it's called. You Should Have Left. Yeah. I believe it is, I don't know. Is it a Netflix thing? I don't know. It's out there and it's a Universal, so it should be out there, but you okay. Should Have Left.
Yeah,
Premium The House Rush, Finds Secret You Window. Is the subtitle there. It's a little concerning. A whole house being able to find me is genuinely terrifying. Like, I open up the door sure. And it's a whole ass house right outside. No, Jesus. Came all the way from Texas, did you?
And then you say, welcome home.
Folks, we've reached the end.
And just like that, Andrew, Pepsi Month has come to a close. And man, does Pepsi Month sound almost like unfairly degrading now at this point, now that we've watched all these movies and appreciated them? Or is it fair? I mean, I personally look at Pepsi as a very gross alternative to Coke, but obviously some people like Pepsi out there. So maybe it is appropriate. Maybe it's just like, not as popular, but has its niche defenders. Maybe that's the more positive way to look at this.
Sure. I mean, okay. we know of at least one man out there that prefers Pepsi to Coke. So, I mean, like, it's not impossible to view that, like, you know, for some people, Pepsi is the superior one. And, you know, most people are wrong, but it's fine. They can think whatever they want. So, you know, but I must say, I largely had a pretty good time watching all of these. It's, I don't know, like, Stir of Echoes also fits into that, like, you know, it's a $12 million movie, so it's not even, like, the $30 million blockbuster. It's, like, a
yeah.
It's like it's almost a small budget movie, but like even Stir of Echoes just feels like something that you just don't see something like that now, and it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, I don't even know where that would, you know, we've said like the $30 million kind of moved to streaming, but this even feels small for like a streaming release today. Like it just feels so quaint almost, but man, it's
that quaint little movie, Stir of Echoes.
I mean, yeah, I don't know where it would fit in today's landscape is all I'm saying. It's probably part of what makes it feel so refreshing to go back and watch, but it's a good time. I loved it. I really enjoyed this month, but like I said, it's over. We are moving into May, which means we have a whole new theme. Well, kind of a whole new theme. We're actually going to be doing a theme we have done before. One of the very first theme months we did whenever we were no longer exclusively doing comic book movies. Ladies and gentlemen, May is video game month 2. A whole month of video game adaptations. Of course, it's a very rich category. We had a lot of fun last time talking Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat, and we've got 4 new video game adaptations lined up for May. It starts next week, where we will be talking about the Dwayne Johnson film Rampage. Andrew, a movie I know you've seen. I haven't seen this one yet. This will be my first time diving into that movie.
Good luck. I'm kidding. But no.
Hashtag
no,
I'm actually, PP, my friend.
I understand. I know the name of the show. But I have not watched this one since it came out, though. And I remember thinking it was just fine. So I will I'm interested to go back and check it out, especially with kind of, I mean, we talked about the man himself on our Black Adam episode. So I am excited to kind of revisit this one, but also kind of see how it frames together with how his legacy is kind of shaping up these days. So I'm curious to go back to this one and see how it did.
Yeah, for sure. And if you want to know our entire lineup for this month, I advise you to hop into our Discord, where we will have posted it by now, I think. So if you want to check out that lineup, it's hard. You record these things ahead of time, the dates. But yeah, you'll want to know. Hop in that Discord. That's where you're going to find out. And if you aren't there already, what are you waiting for? Just click on the link right there in the show notes of this very podcast. Come and join us. Hang out with the community. Talk about all kinds of nerdy stuff. You know, it's not just about the podcast. We talk about comic books and video games and movies and whatever else. Be there. It's free.
Or be square.
Sick burn on our listeners, Andrew. Yeah, check it out. And hey, I know I plug this real briefly at the end of every episode, but we do have a store on TeePublic. So if you want a t-shirt with our logo on it, guess what? You can get one. That link is also in the show notes. If you just want a Best of the Rest sticker, I am really into collecting stickers everywhere I go. I'm holding some up to the camera. I know you at home listening can't see it, but I'm showing Andrew some cool stickers I just bought here. All about plastering my drinking containers with stickers. Anyway, if you want a Best of the Rest sticker, you can buy that as well. If you want a mug, whatever else, there's cool stuff on there. Check out our store on TeePublic. And yeah, that's it. Let's get out of here. Next month, video game month 2, the return, starting with Rampage. And just remember, maybe not every movie is great,
but all movies have greatness.
Thank you to Mark Benavides for singing our theme song. Check him out on Instagram at NotThatMarkAnthony. And thanks to Mitch for the music. You can follow him on Twitter at I'mABiggieBoy. And check our show notes for the SoundCloud link. Check out our store on TeePublic for some Best of the Rest merch. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. That is the only way that we grow. And follow us on social media at BOTRcast. Thank you. We have Catherine Ayerby as Maggie, his wife. I've been referring to him as husband and wife. I think they're married.
Yeah. They're all okay, Witzkies.
Okay. Oh, right, right. Look at the last name. Good detective work, Andrew. Yeah, but she is doing a great job here.
Be as good as Kevin Bacon's and Maxine. My detective work, it won't be as good as
his. I get it.
Because he has to be better than me.
Right, right.
Ah, cut that.